Welcome back, Stripes Show Podcast. I'm your host, Travis Fulton. Welcome into the Travis Fulton Golf Studio here in Jacksonville, Florida. This is going to be the first of four in-studio series podcasts with a live guest, just like we used to do back in the day on the Golf Channel, and I'm really excited about this. This in-studio series, we're going to cover really a wide range of topics. We're going to get into some college and professional golf here in a second with JC. We'll bring him in here to talk here in a minute. But we're also, in December, we've got Marcus Potters, who is one of the top putting coaches in the game, really an up-and-comer. Some of you, I think, maybe have worked with Marcus. He actually does his putting instruction here out of the studio when he is in town. He's actually roommates with Cody Blick, right, who's also part of Access Golf, and Cody's out there on the mini tours. In January, we've got Parker McLaughlin, who I think is the best short game coach in the game. Parker played the PGA Tour for many, many years. He's a good friend of mine. He's been on the podcast a number of times over the years. He's going to join us in January. That's going to be really cool. And then the week before the Players' Championship, I've got Dana Dahlquist, who is a top full swing coach, works with a lot of players, including, really, I think, has done a nice job with Bryson DeChambeau, who has had a nice year this year. So this is the first of four. My title sponsor is Access Golf. Thank you guys for being here. Access Golf is owned by Ken Hollingsworth, a guy that I've known for many years and does so much great work locally in sponsoring up-and-coming young professionals, men and women, on the mini tours. We've got one here joining us as well. Introduce yourself. And
Hi, my name is Alex van der Mosen. I'm from France, and Ken has helped me since college. He's my American dad now. Well, kind of. There's nothing, but if you start to know Ken, he's like someone that helps a lot. I mean, he helped us at JU.
Yeah. Got some players from JU here tonight. Welcome, guys. Yeah, Ken's great. He owns Access Golf, which is a travel company. But more than that, he sponsors up-and-comers and really helps them financially to go out and play and get their skills right and make it. And currently, you're second stage?
Yeah, I'm going second stage in December.
Yep, second stage on the PGA Tour. Ken's also sponsored some teams here. We do a men's league. He's been very helpful in sponsoring some teams for military veterans that are back. We also have Will of Iron right back here, Jeff and Zirmore Spadafore. They're a good partner of mine. If you don't know about Will of Iron, you need to. I just played in their charity event. They do so much good work for veterans locally, but utilizing the game of golf and getting them out, getting them lessons, getting them on the golf course. I've seen it firsthand for the last year and a half, and it's some really, really good work. So thank you for that and for being here. So let's get into this. I want to introduce my guest here of the first of the four. He is the head coach for the University of Florida Gators, but he's also a very good teacher. And he's been on the podcast before. We've talked about a number of his students, including the work that he did with Kurt Kitsuyama, who came onto the scene and won down in Orlando at Bay Hill. But above all that, he's as the coach of the Florida Gators, they won the 2023 National Championship. So it's really cool to have the head coach of the national champion Florida Gators, Mr. J.C. Deacon.
Thanks for having me, Travis. Yeah. Thanks.
So we're going to get into a lot of stuff tonight. We've got a wide range of things, and I'm going to stop talking. I'm going to let J.C. talk here in a minute because I'll keep talking. I mean, I'll go for hours and hours as we start getting into the instructional side, as many of my students know. But before we get into this club here, we're going to kind of really talk about the driver quite a bit here today. And we've got some swings from some of his players that we're going to put up here and we're going to look at. And we're going to talk some about the technique, but in particularly the power game.
Yeah.
Right? And how the game has changed to power. And some of you that are working in here on your technique, it's like, how do I get more power? We're going to get into some of those specifics. That's what we're going to really get into. We're also going to get into some of the play aspect of it. And there's really no one better to speak to, I think, managing technique and play, like course management, than this guy. Right? How do you manage that? Like, what do you look for from a course management strategy standpoint. So we're going to get to that. But before we get to that, I want to ask you, you were a very good player from Canada. You played professionally. You won tournaments as a youngster.
Yeah.
And then you get into coaching and you win a national championship. So my first question is, you know, winning as an individual and winning as a coach, compare that for us.
I don't even think there's a close comparison. It's funny because I grew up, I started playing golf when I was four. My dad and had an older brother, Jeff, who got me into the game. And I've loved golf since I can remember. And it was always about me growing up, you know, and trying to get better. And that's what I love about the game is it's always, you know, a battle against yourself. Obviously you're trying to beat your competition, but it's always about you and getting better every day. I never thought one day in my life about being a coach or a swing coach or a college coach. Mm-hmm. And, I was playing the mini tours and, certainly wasn't making enough money and had just missed in 2010. I missed, second stage, by a shot. And, if I had one shot better, I would have played Korn Ferry Tour Finals. I can't remember how the whole setup was at that point. I think it was still early enough where you could get a PGA Tour card. But anyways, I was down on it, and my college coach out of nowhere called me in February of 2011 and offered me his assistant coach position. And I told him, I'm like, I don't know what it means to be a coach. Not sure what that looks like. Not sure if I want to do that. But I had a great relationship with him, and so he encouraged me to do it, and I went out there, and probably within 2 weeks of the job, I fell in love with the fact that you could help, kids who were, I was 27 at the time, and these kids are, 18 to 22 years old, and you could help them not make the same mistakes that I made, and that was really exciting for me, and that's what initially made me fall in love with college coaching is, shoot, I did this wrong. I wish I would have done that. Now I can help them, not do those same things. So that was the first thing for me. And then you start building a relationship with them and the recruiting part, and you see the whole kind of process and journey build. And it's really, really exciting to be a part of.
You look back and you see some young, inspiring players here in the audience. And we have a lot that follow the podcast as well. So you look back, couple mistakes that you've made, right? And you watch a player come into the system and you're like, man, that was me when I was that age.
Yeah.
What are those one or two things you think?
So when I was 16, I was one of the top two or three players in all of Canada, as a junior golfer. I was winning a lot of the regional stuff, competing at a high level, in the AJGA, and was leading the U.S. Junior after round one when I was 16, shot 65. And
wow.
So I could play, and we just didn't know anything. I had my dad is, a hack, for lack of a better word. He loves the game. But yeah, exactly. best guy in the world, and I owe my dad everything. But not a great golfer, but we just didn't know what to do. So I moved when I was 16 years old to Florida from Canada, and got thrust into a very technical kind of situation. And I was a hockey player, a field player, and I had good hands and a really raw golf swing. So I took on too much technique and internal focus too fast. And that's what I think, looking back, really set me back. So one of the things that we look at with our players is exactly that, what are you focusing on when you're playing? When you're actually swinging that golf club, what's going through your mind? And, I think there's a better way to do it. And, we're constantly, trying to develop that with our guys. And that was just one way that, I got led down a bad, but not that it's a bad path, just the wrong path in my sense. And it's kind of definitely influenced my coaching.
Yeah. Well, the balancing of technique, and we have a lot of coaches that watch the podcast as well, and I'll get feedback from them. And oftentimes with the podcast, I'll have a guest on and we'll put up their players' swings and we'll break them down and we'll show, hey, you know, Rory McIlroy is working on trying to get the shaft a little more horizontal now, and why is that? And so it can come across pretty technical.
Right.
Right. And you get into the technical aspect of, you know, how to use the ground and the geometry and all those things, which is all great stuff. And I think, you know, when you work with students, amateur students who have a job, kids, and golf is like number maybe five on the list, right? And then you retired, it might move up to two or three, but still, you're not a professional golfer. You're not going after it that way, right? And so you're trying to, as I always put it, you're trying to improve the probability of impact. You know, you're trying to layer in things that are going to make them hit higher quality shots. Their bad shots aren't as bad, and just kind of move that needle along, right?
Yeah.
But then as you start getting into a higher skilled player, oftentimes, and even at the amateur level, it's a balance of play, right? Okay, we're working on this, but I also have to go out and play and perform. And so that balance is tough, right? It can be
really,
very tough.
Really difficult.
And we're going to get into some specifics of each one of those
here
in a second. But I want to ask you about this club. I want to ask you about this club, and we've got some JU players here, and I guarantee these guys can probably carry it at least 290 off the tee, at least. 300? Carry?
Yeah. He looks long and lanky. He can bomb it.
Carry 300 off the tee? How is the game? You've been doing this a long time, right? Coaching at Florida for 11 years?
11 years at Florida, 15 years total now.
15 years total. What? How's the game changed in this particular club over that time?
It's everything, to be honest. Coach Dudley Hart, who I'm lucky enough is our associate head coach at Florida, and he played on the PGA Tour for 25 plus years, and blessed to work with him every day and hear his stories and stuff. But we laugh all the time because these guys don't want to have a 7-iron into a green anymore. Like, that was a dream for me growing up, to be able to hit a driver, 3-wood or whatever off the tee and be able to hit a 7-iron into the green. If our guys have a 7-iron into the green now, they're petrified. And not because they can't hit it well. It's just, why do I not have a wedge in? And it's because of the speed numbers now. And I think, you know, when you look at the PGA Tour points list at the end of the year, a lot of the best drivers, strokes gained-wise, are at the top of that list. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it just continues to be proven year after year. If you can hit it long and straight, you have a sizable advantage over your competition.
You know, it's funny, even I think my last year at Golf Channel was 2018, somewhere in there. And we were doing a show, and we were kind of joking about drive for show, putt for dough. And I said, I'd rather be the other way.
It's the other way.
I said, I'd rather drive for dough.
Yeah.
And putt for show.
Yes.
I mean, because that's, and I remember we got some kickback and feedback. No. Like, go look at the driving list. Total driving, you know, and look at those names, and then go look at the putting list and look at those names and tell me which list you'd want to be on.
That's it.
And so the game has flipped. And so you still have to be accurate. You still have to have a short game. You still have to be able to, I get it. You still got to be able to do all those things. But I do think the distance era is here. We're living in it. And the product is certainly very much a part of that. And I always enjoy, and I want to get into some technique here, and look at some swings and get some questions going about this particular club in general. Because, you know, when people come in here, their first question oftentimes is, how do I hit my driver better, right? Like, I can hit every club in my bag, but I can't hit my driver. And I've never met, and I've taught for 25 years, I've never met anybody that can hit every club in their bag except their driver. But oftentimes that becomes the conversation pretty quickly, and then you look at your swing and you're like, okay, well, let's grab a 7-iron and develop a little bit, and then we'll work up to the driver. But eventually you got to get to the driver, and I do like working with students long distance, and we have a lot of people watching long distance that I work with, but also in here and over the years, I like working on the driver, because if I can get them to drive it better, not only hit more fairways, but if I can put 10 to 15 on it, like,
their handicap's going down.
It's going down, but the lasting power of that in the health of the game is far greater than if I can get them to make one more putt, because they're motivated now, right? Like, they are fully motivated. Wow, I am busting it off the tee. I can't make a putt to save my life, but I am busting it off the tee. And, like, you get excited for that. So when we get into some technique with the driver, and I've got a swing here that I'm going to put up. All right? And I want you guys to watch this, because this is a guy, and I'll have you tell the audience who this is. And then we're gonna look at a couple things here and kind of what we can learn from this. Now, we're not gonna learn to carry it 300, like that's not our goal, but there are some things here that I think you see the best drivers in the world do, and this guy can drive it pretty darn good.
Yeah, so this here is Ian Gilligan. Ian, very luckily, we got Ian to transfer from Long Beach State a couple years ago. So unfortunately, we've only got him for 2 years. Last year, he was an All-American for us right out of the gate. And this year, he's headed towards probably even better. He finished 16th on the PGA Tour last week at the Shriners in Las Vegas. So he's played at the highest level of the game and shown he belongs. But this club is so much fun to watch him hit it. And Ian, my favorite part about Ian Gilligan is he plays the game like a little kid. And I remember, you know, when you're, whatever, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, you're always telling your dad or telling your friends, you know, watch this, or I'm going to hit this so hard, or watch this shot. And that's how Ian still plays. He plays with a childlike passion, but Ian's been working with George Genkis, who I'm sure you know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And George is an unbelievable coach. And I think one of the things that makes George so successful is his attitude and enthusiasm about the game. And he's a perfect match for Ian, you know, how they work together. But we'll see in his swing here. There's so many things that he does great. And there's just not a lot of bad days of ball striking for him.
Before we get to that, and George is great. George has been on the pod many times and was actually one of my first guests. I've known him a long time. It's been cool to see his career really take off. He's a wonderful teacher and even better person. But for the audience, and when you look at that setup, to me, this is textbook setup. I think the first thing that I would point out is foot flare. And for some of my students in here, when I'll get them to flare their feet. And when you think foot flare, you oftentimes think the front foot, right? Flare the front foot. But I think in general, when you look at his trail foot, like I think for most, it's good advice to flare that trail foot a little, you know, and what that can offer in the way of how the hip can work. The other thing is when you talk about ball position with the driver, you'll notice it's not so much the heel, right? Oftentimes, I get this question a lot. With the driver, he's playing it inside the left heel. He doesn't have it forward. And the reason is because his feet are wide. Like, these guys get wide. And when they get really wide, really the true checkpoint is really kind of is the shoulder. Like, it's really more like getting it off the left shoulder. So when your feet get really wide, it won't be the heel. It'll be just inside the heel. You know, the lowest point of the arc roughly is kind of that left shoulder. And so you'll see kind of there. The other thing, Terry O'Brien, listen, is the club shaft is not forward. Okay, yeah. Good. The driver is not forward, all right? I mean, you've probably have seen this many times, but with the driver, you know, don't go this way. I mean, get it more neutral. And if anything, the hands can be maybe gently back, and then you can see just kind of the gentle tilt of the spine. To me, this is like so fundamentally sound that for most, if they set up like this with their driver, you're going to have a lot of success.
Yeah.
Now, let's get into the swing. What are some of the things you like about this big guy's swing? How far can he carry it?
Ian can carry it 300 yards for sure.
Okay.
I think, you know, him and George work a lot on setup for sure.
Yeah.
He struggled a little bit this fall with his dispersion because the club, I'm not sure in this swing, but the club was getting too long. So this is a newer swing here where they're trying to maintain the same speed but not take it too far past parallel. But my favorite things about Ian is you can see it obviously right there. His shoulder turn is elite.
Yeah.
He's obviously very flexible and young and can handle that. If I tried to do that now, it would be a rough show. But he's got a huge shoulder turn, really flexible. His width, is tremendous. Look how far his glove hand there is getting away from his, I guess that's his right ear. But I think the one of the things that I've talked to Ian about a lot that I know Gigi helped him with is you can see his club face is essentially pretty shut there. And that's helped him a ton. It's helped him really rotate his body at a faster speed. And his ball speed is, can touch the 180s when he's playing. And when he gets it going, the one thing Travis was mentioning about his ball position, it might be just a hair further back than you'd be normally used to. Ian likes to play a draw. So obviously a little further ball position back is going to help kick his path to the right slightly and help him draw it. So there's not too many pure drawers of the ball left.
And yeah, he's interesting. I want to get to that question here in a minute, draw versus fade. But the one thing that, like, when you look at that, and a lot of people might be looking at that saying, there's no way in hell am I getting that club there, right? And the truth, that is a very true statement for everybody yeah. here. Like to get your hands that far away from your right ear and make that kind of turn with that structure is elite stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, like, elite stuff. But what you can do, okay, is you can turn your right hip. And what you can do is you can extend your spine. And I'll make this statement here. I mean, I give a lot of lessons every week in here. And I lengthen more swings out than I shorten up. Okay, and I've heard, and some of you in here, we've worked on it. We've lengthened you out. And I think the notion is it's the other way, right? It's like, we're going to shorten up and we're getting more compact. But the reality is we get older and amateur players, we tend to go more, in and down this way. And so we get shorter and shorter and shorter, and the swing gets shrunk. And so when you look at his lower back, what you see there is extension. Extension is this. The spine goes this way. And so when you turn, it's okay to extend. It's okay for your spine to take on some of this movement as long as you're keeping your orientation. And when you blend that with that trail hip, it makes for a very healthy turn. And so, I think in building this place, and maybe one of the reasons that Gigi's been so successful is he knows how to teach spine angle.
100%.
And in spine angle, in the golf swing, is moving. It's not staying still. It doesn't stay constant. It's changing. And one of the things that's happening in the backswing is it's taking on extension. And extension helps lengthen out the swing. And you may not, we're not going to get, I can't even demonstrate. I couldn't do that. We're not going to get that kind of width doing that, but we can lengthen out. And when you talk about where I think power and accuracy come together, I think, some of this right hip and this spine
100%
really adds a lot of value to every club in the bag, but in particularly this guy.
Yeah.
In particularly this guy. Now, I want to go to the other view because I want to ask you about this one. Is this your player?
Yeah, this is Ian. Same
okay,
one.
I was like, good. I was
yes.
like,
he just changed
the Florida State player
sneaking
in there.
It was a different day. It was a different day.
Oh, good. I thought it might have been a Seminole.
That's a different player. But,
okay, here we go.
No, this is Ian down the line.
Same guy.
Same guy.
Okay, same guy. All right. I do want to make one note here with this, because this is the other last thing about the setup with the driver. This camera is really well positioned. Can you see how you can see the top of his left forearm? So what that's telling me is that he is square through here. And I think one of the most common errors with the driver is when that ball goes forward, you see players turn and face the forward ball position.
Yeah.
And when they do that, the shoulders open. And so I what helps a lot of people is they get tilted and then they almost feel like they turn their chest a little back here and it gives them a little piece of that forearm. And I just think that's like a real trick of the trade with the driver and that you see in spades with guys like this.
Yeah, the GG's very obsessive about setup, when it comes to Ian, and they work on it really hard. You can tell there he's kind of standing up straight. If you go back to the yep. very start there, he's really worked on that hard, and then you can see him make that little tilt move. Sometimes he leans a little bit too far towards the target and loses a little bit of launch, but he has one of my favorite swings, and it matches his personality, really free flowing and loose, and he just all the time, he'll get up on the tee and go, "Coach, watch this." And you know he's going to absolutely rip it as hard as he can. So
here's another position that none of us got any chance to get into.
Yeah.
And if we did, we would have to be carried out.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just really an incredible position to look at.
Yeah.
His shoulders are darn near at a right angle
yeah.
to the ground.
Yeah.
Wow. Now, here's the last thing, and then we'll go to the next view here. We'll go to the next player. But remember when I said turn that right hip? Here's a good little checkpoint. You see that little window open up in between the knees? And I want to ask you about this, because this to me is how one of the areas that has changed, I think, in hitting a driver in particular. And I think we've learned from the long drive guys. See that little window open up? And so some of you know what's coming here, because I've pulled this back and we've stood here in front of this mirror and we've watched in front of this mirror. But that little window is that right hip climbing, is that right hip turning and climbing, and it's that knee losing a little flexion and that left knee coming across. See that little window open up? And so, you know, when you don't get that turn and you stay locked out, you know, then you don't get any space. So I would say just, and I think Georgia would attest to this, we've talked about it before, is that in the last 15 years, I think one of the areas that has changed, and I'm curious to talk to you guys about your swing afterwards, is what's called change of knee flex. Because when I got into teaching 25 years ago, that's not the way it was taught.
No.
The way it was taught was to turn your upper and to resist with your lower. Keep your right knee flexed.
Yeah.
Is that when you were younger?
I was too. And it was always restricted hip turn. Like, how much shoulder turn can you get without turning your hips? And it was so bad. Like, just so bad. Mm-hmm. And we all have to use every aspect of our body and the ground and whatever we can to generate power.
Yeah.
And obviously, when you look at Ian, he's turning away from the target every possible aspect he can within reason.
Yeah.
So he can, you know, hit it as hard as he possibly can on the way through.
Does that make sense, everybody, about the trail knee, you know, where it's like, I'm going to make sure I'm standing in front of this, where it's you turn and you're like, okay, I'm going to keep my right knee flexed. And when you keep it flexed and you don't, your hip can turn some, but you're not going to get a window. Your hips will stay very level. Your pelvis will stay level. And then when you let it climb, and you let it, that right side climbs a little bit, now the right side of the pelvis gets a little higher, you lose a little flexion, now the left knee comes across. So it's called kind of a change of knee flex. And when you get a change of knee flex, it frees up that lower body, does a lot of other things, encourages the spine to extend, but I think is very much a staple in today's game. And I think, were you taught that way? How old are you?
22.
You're 22? Were you taught that way? Huh? Like this?
Yeah.
It's getting there.
You're doing that with every club?
Yeah, every club. Except the putter. And short game. But yeah, every club. What was that? Sorry. Well, it can. I mean, it's, you know, if it can go up, but, I mean, usually these guys are going to stay pretty level. But oftentimes it feels like you're getting taller if you've never done it before.
Yes.
But it's really fascinating. You said yes too, right?
Yes.
You got three phenomenal young players here, and that's the way they were taught at a young age. That's not the way it was in the 90s and the early 2000s. And I think you have players like Ernie Els, Corey Pavin, who are all great players. I mean, don't get me wrong. Like, you can play great golf not doing this. But you know, those guys, you know, it's a different swing.
It's a
different swing in today's game. Yes, equipment's better, but I can tell you the athlete's better. And I'm just going to say the technique's better, too. I'm just going to say it. Like,
there's no doubt.
That's a big game changer right there.
Yeah.
And I show that move, and yes, he's what, 20, 21?
Ian's 21.
21?
Yes. Yeah.
You know, yes, he's 21, but I show 40-year-olds, 60-year-olds, 80-year-olds all the time how to change knee flex, how to get the right side to climb, how to spine, the, you know, extend the spine, lengthen it out, and it's like, holy crap, that feels different, you know? And it feels like it's super long, and then you show it to him, and you're like, wow, that looks great.
Well, you get that part right, you can add speed fast.
You can go. Yeah, you can go.
Yeah.
You can really, really go from there.
Yeah.
Now, let's go move on here. Any questions on that? Because any, Cart, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so Carson, young player, how old?
13.
13. So we're starting to get some inclination now. We're starting to get more, like, less, you know, young, flexible, really good player can resist, you know, his spine can, but we're starting to get a little more inclination and get the glute a little more engaged and how to use the ground a little bit more, right?
Perfect.
Which, at this age, just like when they were at that age, then all of a sudden you look like them and you'll be carrying a 300.
Yeah. Good coach. It happens fast.
When did it hit for you? When did you feel your biggest distance gain? Just curious.
Probably around the age 16.
16.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's about right.
Yep. Let's go to.
Which one do you want first?
Well, I want to go to this one.
I'm very biased. Okay.
Who's this?
This is a different. So this is Parker Bell.
This is Parker. Yeah. Okay.
Parker is a junior on our team this year, and very interesting story. I was telling Travis about it earlier. Great player when he was 12, 13, 14, 15, and went into a really rough patch of golf, like a lot of us have throughout the years, and was really struggling with his game. And I connected Parker with Jeff Smith, who Travis knows is a fantastic swing coach out of Memphis, and they started working together when Parker was 16. And now this is a product of, this is 200 mile an hour ball speed right here. He's the longest player I've ever had. He just absolutely hammers it all the way throughout the bag. So you'll see some pretty cool things here. Yeah, you're similar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Look at that right leg. You know? Really elongated. See how the right side of his pelvis is higher than his left? Like that's what you're after.
Way higher.
Yeah, that gets that glute engaged, that right glute activated. And there's no bigger muscle in your body than that glute. So that's an awesome. I mean, just. And what's funny is, you know, you can get people to look at that. Now it's harder to get someone to look like that coming through. Like that's a little more dynamic and like, you know, I mean. Getting someone to open up like that is a little more difficult. It's doable, and you got to have some things in place to get someone to rotate aggressively like that. But I promise you, you can get. I haven't met many that can't look like that right there. I haven't met, no matter the age.
You can get there.
I want to go to this. I want to go to. Where was that face on one here? Hold on a second. This one. This is who?
So this is Jack Turner.
Jack. Okay, yeah.
Jack's from, his family, mom, Claire and Rich, live in Orlando at Bay Hill now. But Jack grew up in Massachusetts and luckily for us moved to Florida to go to an academy. And he's a sophomore on our team and had a wonderful freshman year. He was an All-American last year. As a freshman, and this is a dangerous statement. Dudley always laughs at me about exaggerating too much, but Jack might have my favorite swing that I've ever coached.
Well, that's a big statement.
It's so simple. It's so productive, and we'll get to a point here post impact of a spot that he gets to that, is just elite club face control. And, you know, he's gained a lot of speed in the last year and a half. He's turning into a superstar. And if I had to bet my kid's college fund on it, he's probably gonna probably going to play on the PGA Tour one day.
Like Fred Biondi, who has now got his card.
Yeah, well, Fred got his Korn Ferry Tour card right out of PGA Tour
right.
University, and had he was a two-time first-team All-American at Florida, had a great career, and actually went through a little bit of a struggle on the Korn Ferry Tour this year. So Freddie's back to the grind, but he will be on the PGA Tour one day. I'd bet on it.
So here's what that change of knee flex looks from the other view. And you could kind of anticipate how you would see the space, right? Like how dynamic that right hip looks, and notice the left knee coming across. I mean, these are all things that, again, all of us can do. And I want to lead to this because we were talking about this. When you climb the right side and the spine extends, what it does is it creates now this angle and this orientation where your weight shift can move not only left, but it can kind of move down into the ground. And it's called like the pitcher's mound effect. Like if you think about it, like a pitcher's mound, if I'm on the pitcher's mound, I can fall down the mound. I can use that. Right. So when the right side climbs and you extend, see, now I've created that pitcher's mound where I can kind of fall left. Right. Now, it's not quite as severe as a pitcher's mound, but
right.
But you get the sense that I can kind of climb and then fall. And to me, when I look at this, like, and you want to talk about falling left, you want to talk about falling left and turning. I mean, this is. See that? And that's, and I know he's falling because he's got his belt buckle and his chin are neutral. So he's still kind of stacked. Here's the opposite of a fall. Watch this. This is not as powerful. That's called a bump. Right? A bump. See, my pelvis is over there, but my spine's back here. You've lost touch with the ground. Right? It's almost like throwing the ball in that step, you know, kind
right.
of thing. You know, it's like for this, you're stepping and then going, where he's still stacked up. So it's a different kind of dynamic. And when you talk about using the ground, which is heard a lot on TV, like this is more the definitive part of it. This is how you use the ground. This is, you create a pitcher's mound and then you know, now you can fall into the ground.
Yeah.
And when you fall into the ground, what's the ground going to tell you to do from there?
Push up.
Push back off. So he's falling into the ground, and then now when the jets hit, now it's like, okay, it's go time. Watch this left leg. Now he's going to push back up. So that's the energy. You know, that's the energy of the ground is climb and then fall, and then it's like back up again. Golf
yeah,
swing.
Jack's not a huge guy. He's trying to put on weight constantly. But he has such a great mix of power and precision together. It's just such a great combination. So that this is him down the line
yep.
here.
Not bad. You know what's funny from this view is that I think everybody can achieve what you're looking at from this view. And when you watch this swing, because you, what do you like from here? When you look at, because this is your favorite one, right?
He just, it's so simple. There's so few moving parts with his wrist angle and the club face. Mm-hmm. But if you take it just post impact, Jack will laugh right. Hang on, hit the ball right there.
Yeah.
So you guys can all see like. Fully released, fully extended, and his club face is just so square to that
yeah.
arc. And the toe hasn't flipped over, which I unfortunately really, really struggle with. But, you know, we look for this position a lot now in junior golfers and players that we're looking for. He's so elite with that spot, and he just doesn't have a lot of bad ball striking days. And everything's kind of going left through the ball, and that ball's going right down the target line and just doesn't hit a lot of bad shots. He's such a great ball striker.
Here's where the other area of like modern teaching has, I think, has progressed. And I'm curious to get these thoughts. Halfway back, angle that club face. Everyone see the club face?
Changed a lot.
See the toe?
Yeah.
It's like this. Was that at all when you guys get the face here or here? Here, yeah.
And I got taught to have that toe wide open.
Yeah, a little more open. Yeah.
You know it's open now, yeah.
So I think, you know, the rotation of the face to there, see the toe? That was for years and years. It was kind of rotate the face, toe up, rotate the face this way.
Good for short game.
Very good, yeah. And I think two things happen when you rotate the face. One is usually, there's a few people in here, I'm not going to make eye contact with them, but they get that, where's that, a club head gets behind the hands quick, right? And when the club head gets in behind the hands quick, where are you going to go from here? Back over the top, usually, yeah. Right? And so when you keep the face kind of looking more down, it tends to keep the club head a little more out in front of you, which I think for most people, that's good advice. Because I think the most common error in golf that I see in amateurs, and this is for the audience everywhere, is this. Inside. Club head gets behind the hands quick.
Death move.
Yeah.
To me.
Some would let it go. You know, it's interesting.
In my experience, yep. And that's kind of a personal bias for me, because yep. I was open and inside with the club head behind me, and I had good days, yeah. But I struggled with consistency, and you know, I see that position right there. That's what I would dream yeah. for my little son to have one day.
Yeah, that's a really good spot right there. The shaft yeah. parallel to the toe line, club face, see the toe just slightly down. It's just so clean, and then when you counter that with the turning of the right hip, right side of the pelvis climbing, like the club shaft's going to get shaped pretty darn good.
Yeah. Elbows then, staying pretty close together. He's got such a tight, compact.
And then from there, the club can shallow just a little bit. And I want to get your thoughts on that, the shallowing of the shaft. How many of you, you got to shallow the shaft, right? And there's people in here that have learned to do that. And the concept of shallowing, and I want to finish from a technique standpoint with this, because I want to get into some of the play aspect with you in the course.
Yeah.
But the idea of you got to shallow the shaft out, and basically all that means is that shaft is working towards horizontal in transition. So here's vertical, and then here's horizontal, and so the club in transition. When you watch it, well, see the club right there? Not quite vertical, right? But watch in transition coming down, it's going to go closer to horizontal. See that? So it's subtle. With him, it's more subtle. It's like there to there.
Really subtle, yeah.
It's not there to there. Okay? And if when you go in here, most of the time you're going to want to go there. Not always, but. And so you don't get that shallowing of yeah. the shaft, right?
Yeah, I think, you know, I'm really lucky because, you know, most of the players that show up on our doorstep are already really, really good
yeah.
players.
Yeah.
So we don't have to coach that stuff too often. Yeah. They just do it instinctually.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, I would completely agree with you. Most of the great players, that we see just kind of do that naturally and don't have to think too much of it. But if you're going the other way and coming over top of it, you know, that's where
yeah.
I think it makes it really tough to be consistent.
Yeah. So I think the takeaways from a technique and for the audience to think about is that, okay, where we've got the driver set up and then we've kind of got the idea of, all right, I'm going to be kind of there and I'm going to turn my right hip, change the knee flex. But you've really, you know, you've got things pretty well structured at that point to where when then you do change direction, you know, that shaft then wants to go there. And I think the greatest example of that, sticking with George, is Matthew Wolff. Nobody has the shaft more vertical than Matthew Wolff. In
yeah.
fact, it's the other way.
Yeah.
But when you really think about it, right, if you wanted to shallow the shaft, don't you have to from there? Or you'd never hit it, right? So it's like, how am I going to get that? Like, am I going to do that? So I got to go like that. And so what you see mainly in today's game is you see the club stay there with the face square, right side climbs, and then change direction as they fall left. Now the shaft shallows a little. And it doesn't have to be a dramatic amount, but the shaft does.
Yeah, Matt Wolf was obviously drastic, but talk about drivers of the golf ball. He played 2 years at Oklahoma State, and we played against them a ton those couple years, and that's some of the best driving I've ever seen.
Yeah.
It was so long and so straight and so violent. It was amazing to watch. Matt could really drive it.
It's interesting. Some of the biggest shallowers are the straightest drivers.
Yeah, Sergio is another one.
Sergio, Victor Hovland is another.
Yeah.
You know, Victor Hovland can hit it through a thimble off the tee.
Sure, back in there.
And that guy, I don't think anybody shallows it more than Victor Hovland. And again, you can see that on TV. So anyway,
I love his golf
stuff. Those are some things that take go. Any questions on that before we finish up with? I want to talk a little course management here and strategy. But any thoughts on some of the driver stuff there? I know some of you are shaking your head like, yeah, that's what I'm working on and kind of reinforcing. But sometimes when you use swings, it's like, man, why is he using a 21-year-old? I'm never going to be that. Well, yeah, you can have pieces of that.
Yeah.
You can have pieces of that. You're not going to do it at that speed. But you can change knee flex. You can have your right side of your pelvis higher. You can extend your spine. You can get the face square. You can shallow the shaft a little. And as you learn those pieces and put it together, man, the ceiling just goes higher and higher.
That's good advice.
Yep. The greatest change of knee flex are long drive guys. Just watch them. I mean, it is unbelievable how up they take that thing and then fall and just do their thing.
Murder it. Those guys are amazing.
All right, so let's finish with this. Let's talk a little strategy in play. One of the things you talk about with your players is bogey avoidance.
Yep.
For a lot of us, bogey avoidance applies, but sometimes it can be double bogey avoidance, right?
Yep.
It's like, don't make the big number. Cruising along, playing pretty good, but every time I make two doubles or three doubles or whatever, right? How do you talk through that? What are some of the areas to look at from a strategy standpoint?
Yeah, I mean, it's probably the biggest difference maker on our level. These guys would know, every Division I golfer, for the most part, that's starting in their lineup can make, three, four, five, six, seven birdies around. That would happen a lot in your junior career. And it's, how do you make those count? How do you make seven birdies, one bogey, six birdies, no bogeys, where you can have those low rounds? And probably more importantly is the day that you make two birdies, how can you make one birdie or none so that you shoot under par or even? And there's obviously a million different things that go into this, but I think probably decision making is number one. And I was guilty of it, and pretty much every player that we ever have show up on our campus, you grow up aiming at a flag, and that's what you're taught, and that's the name of the game, and that's where you're trying to get the ball. But, you start playing the golf courses that we play. We played Sahali, Olympia Fields, Muir Field, and Eagle Point this fall. Four incredibly difficult Wow. golf courses with firm, fast greens. So you start short-siding yourself on courses like that, it's just going to make it really, really hard to get it up and down. So we are constantly on our guys about decision-making. Okay, where do I have to put the ball off the tee to put it in the right spot into the green where I can, if I miss the green, I can get it up and down. And if I hit the green, I've got an easier two-putt. And then, you've got to develop a wedge game where if you're driving it well enough and you get a wedge in, you can stuff it. And we talk about that a lot. We want to build a wedge game where there's no pin that's off limits with our wedges. Hmm. And, the best part of building a wedge game is if you drive it poorly, you can always lay it up to a wedge and get that up and down and save par. So there's a lot that goes into saving shots, but, we still have a redshirt freshman on our team right now, Rylan Shim. We're still trying to figure out his puzzle of not making double bogeys. He had way too many of them this fall, and he's making the birdies and the eagles, and the offense is there. But he's still got to figure out, just lack of focus, emotional control, all those little things that go into it.
Do you think, so let's talk off the tee for a second. One shot. So like you have a fade or a draw, right? How often are they like, I'm going to fade it here, or draw it here? Is it mainly like we have one curve, we're hitting that 95% of the time, and then if I have to, I'll go the other way? Or is it?
I am a huge believer in that. That's what I've seen in 15 years of coaching of the best players is they have one shot off the tee that they're great at. Fade, draw, low, high, whatever it happens to be. I think when you start playing in a lot of wind, it gets tricky. And yeah, you probably want to have a shot that you can work into the wind. Maybe with a three wood, you know, for faders, it's always a little easier to draw it with a three wood because you got a little more loft on the club. Mm-hmm. So I always want to be able to work it, but I think probably a 90% rule is pretty good where you're hitting that same shot 90% of the time and you just got to own it. And you look at those three guys there. Parker probably moves the ball around a little bit more, but Ian's trying to hit the same shot, that little draw 90% of the time. And same with Jack, he swings so good. It's everything straight. So that makes it easy.
So I think for like all of us too, like off the tee, we think, all right, the one thing I would ask is when I'm cruising, what does the ball do? Right? Like it dies right. You know, and I can turn it right to left, but then I get bigger misses and the whole thing. But I think we have a shot off the tee and we hit that. And then we ask ourselves, okay, when I miss it, where does it go? Like, what is that big miss? And then you want to try to, if the big miss is constant, then you want to try to move some technique away from that a little bit, right? You want to try to steer away from that a little and make that big miss not as severe. What I wouldn't say, and I think I'm hearing you right, is, okay, it's dog leg right to left, I'm going to try to draw it.
Yeah.
Now the next hole is, it's dog leg left to right, I'm going to try to fade it. And then it's like, no, take your line and hit your shot. You know, hit your one curve. Keep it simple, right?
Yeah,
Is that what you're trying to say off the tee?
Yes, but I think that's like you're getting into the next level now. You know, every golfer, you guys know, being great players, you get into spots in a tournament where you don't feel comfortable.
Yeah.
So that's an elite skill there. Okay, I don't feel comfortable. I don't like this shot. I don't like this wind. I don't like the way this hole looks. I'm just going to hit a three wood or a three iron or whatever that gets me.
Yeah.
These guys hit their two irons and three irons. Parker hits his two iron 290, 280. You know, so he doesn't have to hit driver. You don't always have to force drivers. So
it's time to put it down.
That's it.
Irons into greens. Green, when to go versus when not to go. Strategy now, okay? What have you found with your players and just maybe from amateurs in general? Like, too aggressive in general? Are we like, I've got a 7-iron, back left pin. I'm going, right? Like I'm going at it instead of, no, I'm going to go middle and just hit it there.
It's a tough battle that Dudley and I are constantly fighting. Two of the best players I've ever had, Ricky Castillo, who just got his PGA Tour card on the Korn Ferry Tour this year. He'll be playing out there full time next year. He was probably the most conservative player I've ever had in 15 years of coaching. And
when you say conservative, like middle, like he's not going flag hunting.
So Ricky, like great understanding of who he was. He believes in his mind he's the best lag putter in the entire world.
Oh, wow.
So if he's not feeling right or a shot doesn't look right or a scenario's not, he just, coach, get me on the green and I'll two putt it. And he was amazing at that. It could be a pitching wedge that my eye said was an easy shot and looked simple. And he's like, nah, I'm just going to hit it to 20 feet and, you know, hopefully I'll make the putt. And you just continually stack the risk on your side and taking risk out of the game. It pays. He just makes less bogeys. And Sam Horsfield was another one. He's a great player on LIV, playing on the Majestics and making lots of money doing it, which is awesome.
Really
proud of him. The Majestics. Live tour? Are we not allowed to talk about that?
I've never heard of it.
I got to be open to everything. Yeah. As long as my guys are successful and making money, I'm happy. This coach is happy. But Sam was another one, you know, great putter, but he could just know when to not be aggressive and when to back off and take a pass on a shot and get the ball on the green and get out of there with a par. I think that's such a great skill for elite players.
How many have ever played rounds of golf where you aim at the center of the green every time? No matter what? Never?
They would all improve their score immediately.
Everybody's like, turn around, like, you look at that man. Right?
It's not, maybe not as much fun, but you would improve your score so fast.
It is interesting. When you start wanting to eliminate double bogeys, you usually, I mean, look, technique plays into that, bad swings, we know that. But from a strategy standpoint, I think in general, it's been seen and proven, like, we're just very aggressive, right? Like, we're aggressive off the tee, we're aggressive into greens. We're aggressive into greens in flag hunting. And it's interesting, and it just, I've done it lately when I play, just aim at center of the green. Like, okay, I got a 9-iron, like, golly, no. You know, okay, 20 feet, just like Ricky.
Yeah.
You know, 20 feet, 20, and then, okay, then go from there.
Yeah.
It does take stress off. It's interesting. It does teach you some stuff. It does teach you some discipline in its own way to be a little more conservative.
Well, you're aiming at a much bigger target.
At a much bigger target. And so I think you learn from that. And then there is times, right, when you are more skilled that, okay, there's no pin that we can't go out with a wedge. We can go at them with wedges, right? And maybe a 9 or an 8. But you know, you're standing there with a 5-iron, you're like, you know, back right pin, and it's like, yeah, I'm going to carve that thing in there. And it's like, geez, what? You know, like, you know, just, no, aim it left center of the green, and then, you know, we'll go from there. So strategy and double bogey avoidance from my years of on course with students, amateurs, is let's move away from the big miss and let's probably play a little more conservative golf, in particularly into greens.
Yeah.
And then from there, I think the short game can kind of take its own identity, right?
Well, I think there's a book that changed my life by Mark Brody. Mark Brody's responsible for Strokes Gained that we all, us golf geeks, enjoy for the stats that you get on the PGA Tour. And Mark wrote a book called Every Shot Counts. Mm. And it talks about strokes gain and exactly how that's calculated. And I'd encourage anyone to read that. It definitely changed my coaching career and the way I look at strategy and the way I look at golf. And, you know, a lot of our guys that, you know, you look at Hideki Matsuyama does it all the time. He'll hit a 200-yard shot to 15 feet and he's got one hand off the club and looks unhappy. Well, that's crushing the best players in the world, you know. So understanding expectations and what you should do from 170 yards and what the best players in the world do, I think is really important for elite level scoring.
Yeah, and I think it's a good point just from an expectation
yes,
level.
Yes, perfect word. Yes.
You know, and like the one thing I've noticed with amateur players is when you expect this and if that's out of alignment with, you know, what we see from the best players, but also out of alignment with how much time they put into it, when that gap's big, frustration usually kicks in pretty
quick. You get pissed.
The narrower that gap is, the more they enjoy the game. And then usually, like, you can progress them technically to improve the skill set to raise the ceiling.
Yeah.
If you can keep that gap narrowed. And that's easier said than done. Everybody in here manages that beautifully, by the way. I love all of you guys. You manage that expectation level. But it's true. Like, it's you know, it's like, I expect this. I've played for 2 years. I'm doing this. I should be shooting this. And it's like, well, okay. I mean, that's a lofty goal, but it's probably not the reality. Like, you have a job, and we have to kind of, you know, put a little bit of time into that and go through the ups and downs of golf. I mean, we're sitting, you guys are what, probably +2, +3, +4 handicap. These guys are next generation professional golfers. And I'll ask you, what's the lowest round you've shot?
61.
Give me your last 10 rounds, just in general, scores.
71, 72, 75, 71, 72.
Okay. Okay. So how about here? Last 10.
69, 74, 72.
Okay. Okay. So 68, 74. Have you guys ever shot 76? Like in the last 6 months?
Of course.
Have you shot 67 in the last 6 months?
Yeah.
Okay, so this is this curve, what I'm explaining to you. So 67, 76. You know what's crazy? Sometimes those can happen on back-to-back days, right? So are they inconsistent? Right? Right. You know, these are plus four handicaps, five, whatever. 67, 76. You know, that's a nine-shot gap. Other side, come in, I shot, hey, I shot 82, but then I went back out 3 days later and I shot 91. I'm so inconsistent. No, you're not. I mean, that is the bell curve of golf. Like, everybody has that bell curve. And I heard a lot of 69, 70, 71. So in the middle of that bell curve, a bunch of 70s and 71s and 72s, and right, a bunch of them. But then as that curve comes down, it's like, okay, 73, 74, 76, 78, that was a bad day. But then it goes the other way, right? And so that bell curve is all of us. And it's a range of 9, 10, 11, 12 shots. That is consistent. That is you.
That's what drives us all nuts.
That's what drives us all nuts.
Yeah.
And you know who it's no different for? These guys.
Yeah.
And it's no different than what you're going to watch this weekend in Mexico. You know what somebody's going to shoot? What was it the other day? Someone shot a couple weeks ago, 63, 75.
Well, that's the hardest thing in golf is to follow up a super low round.
Yeah.
I don't know why. No one's ever explained that.
I think it's just golf. I mean, that bell curve is golf, that range. So I think explaining that to the audience helps that expectation level of managing. You're not inconsistent. Now, if you keep shooting, if you're a 10 handicap, in the middle of your bell curve is 82, 83, just keep it math simple, and all of a sudden, my God, I'm shooting 92 all of the time, you got a problem. Like, you got something's going on, right, you know? And there's a couple people who I've known for years that have come in here and they lost their game. And that they were going the wrong way. That bell curve was shifting. Their skill set was going the other way. And so that's when you got to call me. So tell your friend, you know, call me and we come in and we look at it and we say, you know what? Here's what we need to do to start shifting the bell curve back the other way. And sometimes it's putting, sometimes it's short game. Sometimes it's full swing, sometimes it's all, but whatever. You know, all of that is job security, right?
Yeah.
It's like, you know, thank God that bell curve goes the other way sometimes.
Low scores help everything.
But you've got to, you know, usually have to rearrange some things from a technical standpoint to start moving the bell curve the other way. But the point being is that range, you're not inconsistent. Don't beat yourself up. You're not inconsistent, right? I'm sure you guys internally go through that, don't you? I mean, God, it's like I just shot 65 yesterday and I shot 74 in the world, right? I mean, it's
cool.
We're all in it together.
Yep.
I mean, it's like we're all in it together. Last I checked, Jordan Spieth, you know, lost his game. You had one of these guys, you told me he shot 85 his senior year in high school?
Junior year, Parker. Parker Bell had a tough go in his junior year. Mm-hmm. He was world-class youngster and just hit a rough patch, didn't really understand his technique and his golf swing and lost control of the ball, and it can get away from you pretty fast. We've seen it happen a lot. But the cool thing is with this game is if you get the right information and working with the right person, it can come back really fast if you have the ability.
And Jeff's great at that. The right info in the right order, that's the key. Teachers separate themselves is the order. Like, you've got to develop it in order. And once you get it in order, then you can start shifting the bell curve the other way. And that's what I got. Let's finish with this, and then we'll open it up. That's my five-second spill on enjoying the game, managing that. Right, what advice would you give the audience on enjoying the game, not only now, but for years to come? You've learned.
I think the biggest thing is adversity is a part of it. You know, if we can all just embrace that and somehow enjoy it, I'm probably not the best one to sit up here and preach about that, because I'll have some playing partners from 20 years ago when I was playing pro golf that know that I got as upset as anyone. And the game will drive you nuts. It drives my dad nuts, who has no business ever getting upset about a shot. And that's for all of us. But as long as you understand that's part of the process, and maybe in a sick way part of the fun, that the highs are so high and the lows can be low, but it's such a great game. I think that the social part of it's amazing. You know, obviously I might be a little biased. It's golf's given me my whole life, and great family and wife, and all the things that I have now is from this great game. And I still, you know, I don't get as much time to practice and play anymore, but I love getting out on the range and working on my game and trying to be a better player than I was yesterday. And that never ends. It's, yeah. You know, that's really cool. You know, having the honor of working with Dudley Hart at Florida, you know, he played on the PGA Tour forever, and he still gets there in the morning to our facility and works on his game and tries to get better and is trying to improve his deal. So it's a never ending process, which is frustrating at times,
yeah.
but also, you know, the beauty of our game. And, you know, in this day and age that we're in, I'm probably preaching too much here, but integrity is a big part of it. I think that's really cool that, you know, we call penalties on ourselves, and you keep your own score and someone else's score, and that matters. And,
yeah.
And, I really love that about golf.
You've got some collegiate players here. You got a young man right here who's 13, aspirations, maybe college golf. I think so. I thought I, you know, what would you tell them? Hey, I want to play collegiately. He wants to play collegiately. You guys professionally, right? One day.
Make sure no one's outworking you. Golf, unfortunately, just takes a lot of time. And a lot of learning and a lot of reps. So all those bad rounds that I used to get frustrated about and try and forget, that was the worst mindset I could have possibly had. Mm. The bad days are the ones you need to learn the most from, and take a deep dive into it. Okay, you know, why did I make this double? Why did I make this triple? Why did I make that bogey? You know, and it's a mental thing sometimes, a physical thing. But if you're working really hard and you're learning from your mistakes and your bad rounds, and loving the whole process, we constantly see people getting better. And that's like, you know, if you just start to love the improvement and the process of it and seeing yourself get a little bit better, I'm jealous of him because he's, you know, he's 13, got the whole world in front of him. And if you work harder than everyone else and you get strong and fast like these guys over here, and obviously you got to have speed these days.
Mm-hmm.
That's just a part of it, but that's all in your control at your age. And that's the neat part about golf is, you know, every different shape and size is on the PGA Tour. No one, you know, doesn't have a chance to make it in golf. So if you put in the time and you love the process and you learn from the bad days, it's really rewarding.
Yeah. Awesome. Any, open it up to you guys. Questions on Jeff.
Hey, you mentioned earlier about playing some really tough courses earlier in the year. With all the great simulator technology that's out there, to what extent are you like walking your team through the courses, maybe like on a simulator and being like, hey, on the approach to this shot, think about this. This is not a good spot to miss. This, you know, how is the advent of all this different technology changed the way you approach rounds ahead of time?
Such a good question.
Yep.
We haven't gone as far as using a simulator to play a course beforehand. Probably should. It's actually a really good idea. But you know, strategy is such a tough thing because you look at those three guys that we went over their swings. They play the game so much differently, and their eyes see different things. So it's tricky as a college golf coach to have one strategy for an entire team. So it kind of bends, like Fred Biondi, who you brought up earlier, and Jack Turner, like they have their rule with driver is there's no rule. If they want to hit driver, they hit it wherever they want. But, you know, we played a course or a hole at the Williams Cup last week, which is at Eagle Point, and the sixth hole is a super penal par five. And it was maybe the first time in my entire coaching career there was no driver, no three wood allowed. We were just going to play it this way as a team. They all committed to it, and we had a really, really successful week doing it. So we probably, you know, Dudley and I, we were both players at times and want the guys to have their own process and freedom in developing and putting a game plan together. But it was really successful last week. So I think, you know, it's kind of given us some ideas going forward of, you know, when we see some danger areas, you know, maybe it's a little bit more upon us to point those things out and steer our guys clear of that.
I will say this coming generation, you're going to see more of that. You know, I think maybe when they were younger, 12, 13, Sims were not quite as popular indoor golf. Miles Russell, who you know, one of the best junior players in the country, in the world, left-handed player, he came in here and played San Marco. What is it? Not San Marco. Jesus. Marco Simone, which is where the junior Ryder Cup was. So the Ryder Cup, and so he was on the junior Ryder Cup team. And so he came in here and he played that course, 18 holes. And he played with, I'm drawing a blank. Not Sam Ryder. Who's the other local guy on the PGA Tour? Help me out here, Jacksonville.
Cam.
Huh? Not Cam. Cam's been here. He's coming to hit on the sim. Anyway, I'll think.
A lot of tour players.
They played 18 holes together. It was awesome. They played the whole course and just teed and they were kind of looking at just nothing like real serious, but just the fact that he saw it and played it. I do think that is somewhat part of the next gen.
I actually have a cool story about that. So Ricky Castillo, as he pronounced it, who's playing on the PGA Tour next year. So we were playing the SEC Championship, and every year we play the SEC Championship at Sea Island on the Seaside course. And Ricky played poorly the first round. And anyways, we order dinner at the house we're staying at, and dinner comes, and everyone's eating, having dinner, and where's Ricky? No one knew where he was. So one of our freshmen go downstairs, and Ricky's sitting about 4 feet from the TV watching the RSM coverage from YouTube that he had up projected on the TV and learning about the golf course and what those guys were doing and what clubs they were hitting off the tee. So we're lucky enough to play a lot of PGA Tour golf courses, and a lot of our guys now will go back and watch footage of the tour players playing there and seeing what clubs they hit and seeing how their strategy is. So you can definitely use it in your
sure.
advantage.
Lanto Griffin.
I've worked with guys on chips.
Lanto.
Before we went into a port that people hadn't been to, kind of see the landmarks, see the things.
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting to see how that.
You can never prepare enough for a golf tournament.
Yeah, I think it's part of it. I really do. I think it's, you know, Sims have their deficiencies in the way they measure it, and some are a little different than others. But you're not really probably, you know, track. You're not really, you know, seeing exactly how far you're hitting each club, but you're at least seeing, okay, here's this, and hit it. And then when you get on that tee, it's like, oh, yeah, it's kind of recognizable. I've
hit that shot
kind
before.
Of been here before. And so there's some familiarity with that. Lanto Griffin was the tour player who's just the best, played with Miles. And it was a very spirited batch. It was good. I mean, Lanto kind of got off to a slow start, and then he picked it up. He's like, okay.
I can talk about Lanto. I can't talk about the other guy.
Yeah, you can't talk about the other guy.
He's still too young. Yeah.
Good question, though. Yeah. Anyway, yeah.
What's a good pre-shot?
Another great question. Literally in practice, we make our guys work on their routine. It's that important. And Dudley's, you know, I keep talking about Dudley, but he's so smart and had a great career on the PGA Tour for that long. And one of the things that Dr. Bob Rotella taught him early in his career was about his routine. And I always thought it was important. I picked it up off Tiger Woods. I just always, you watch Tiger forever throughout all these years. You watch footage from the U.S. Amateur when he was winning those back in the late 90s to playing on the PGA Tour in 2015, his routine's the same. And so having a great routine that you can rely on that's the exact same every time. So our guys will be going through their routine and we'll time it, you know, and we want it to be within half a second every single time. That's putting, chipping, all of it. And it's different for everyone. Some guys like to look at the target 3-4 times. You know, Tiger looks at it twice. You know, it's that's all personal. But you've got to build a routine because it's really you asked a phenomenal question about development and getting better and being in the present. You can make a double bogey, but if you get up to that next tee and you can say to yourself, all right, I'm just going to go through my routine perfectly and execute the shot with full commitment, that's all you can do. Wow. And that helps you forget about what just happened 10 or 15 minutes earlier that, you know, obviously hurts. You know, it hurts when you make double and no one wants to go through that. But if you can get up to that next shot and fully commit to your routine and your target, gives you the best chance to hit a good shot.
Within half a second.
That's what would be our ultimate goal.
Wow. That's from like the moment they walk in to the moment they pull the trigger.
Yeah. So whatever we'll establish what the trigger of the start of your routine is. We'll start the clock and we want it to be within half a second. So we'll make the guys go through 5 or 6 shots, time each one of them, and they should all be right there kind of in the 8 to 18 second range, depending on.
That's good advice. That's really good advice.
If you can build, I'd watch, if I was a young golfer, I always used to look at Tiger Woods' swing and his power and was enamored by that. I would go back and look at his routine and copy that and try and build a perfect routine like Tiger Woods. I know his dad obsessively coached him on that. You can just tell. And it is as good as anyone that's ever played the game.
And you're working on that on the range, not the course.
In practice, we are putting our guys through it. They think we're crazy.
No, I mean,
sure.
But look, how many practice a routine on the range and simulate the shot and, you know, go through the you know, next one.
Almost no one.
Next one. So, yeah, playing as if you're hitting balls as if you're on the course, right? And training
that's
that routine.
Like, you think about football or basketball. Claude Harmon, who's a great friend of mine, he talks about this all the time and compares golf to other sports. Like football, when you scrimmage, you're going through exactly what's going to happen in the game on Saturday or Sunday. We don't do that in golf.
Yeah.
We just sit on the range and you hit a million balls or chip a million balls or take 6 balls and putt them on the green. If you can take time to actually practice what you're going to face the next day or in that tournament, it can give you a lot of peace of mind, in my opinion.
That's good stuff.
Yeah.
When it comes to practice time, putting, short game, full swing, what's the allocation?
Another really good question. So we get 20 hours a week with our guys, and all of the time that we have dedicated just to practice, like range, short game practice, we've tried to identify the things that they don't do on their own time. Everyone loves going to the range and ripping drivers as hard as they can. They'll sit there and hit 7 irons for 3 hours straight, but they don't work on their pitching. They don't work enough on their chipping. They don't work enough on their bunker play. They don't work enough on their lag putting. So those are all that we, in those 20 hours, we spend a lot of time on all the things that they don't work on their own. So for my peace of mind, when, you know, I know when we're going to a tournament, if our guys are really efficient in these areas, you know, we don't have to hit the ball perfectly to be really competitive. Every time the Florida Gators go and play, I'm pretty we'll still have our bad tournaments at times, but we don't have to play our best to be competitive. And that's, I think, because we're spending so much time on those areas of the game that a lot of people don't focus on. It's kind of, it's specific to each person. But I mean, you put a college golfer out on the range, they're going to, you know, especially around a group of guys on a team, they're going to rip drivers at full speed. So I know they're going to do that on their own time. I don't have to make them do it on our time. But, you know, are they going to go through a TrackMan wedge test? Are they going to go through a ladder test going through yardages at 5-yard increments? Are they going to go through their routine? Are they going to pick spots chipping to, you know, and pick different clubs and, you know, change variables? That's the stuff they probably won't do. I, at least when I started coaching, watching them practice, that's what they didn't do on their own time. So we just started to implement all the things that we thought that they were lacking, that are kind of the lowest hanging fruit. And you make them work really hard on that. And we've seen some results really, really quickly.
But I think, just to elaborate that to the amateur, maybe, I think, you know, if you had, you know, time is, you know, of the essence, right? Like, how much time do we have? And if you have, you're spending a couple days at the golf course a week, or two or three, then, you know, you might have a play day or two play days, and then you might have, you know, one practice day. You know, and you just have a practice day where you can spend an hour, hour and a half, and, you know, maybe you split it up into thirds. You know, you have a, you have your ball striking, and then you have your short game, and then you have your putting. And you, you know, you give each one some assist, you know, you give each one some time. But there is moments where it's like we have weaknesses and we need to spend more time on the weakness, right? It's like my driver's killing me. I need to get rid of the slice. Okay, well, maybe we need to spend more time on the driver and get 100%. That right. But then it's like, okay, it's nice. You're hitting it better. And then, okay, then, but don't neglect the other parts of your game. And so I think you got to, I always say, look, play once, practice once before you come back. You know, if you can play once and you can practice once before you come back, that'd be great. Yep. Now, if you can do that twice, great. But you got to have some time on the range where you're thinking about what we did.
Yeah.
At least. Now, if you can do that on the course and have some value, that's great. But you got to be able to take the score out for a moment and just focus on what you've learned and try to develop that.
Yeah, we're at, you know, different spots. He's, you know, technically coaching a lot and helping people develop their swing and their game. My job, you know, is to produce scores. And that's what these guys want and that's what these guys need. They need to play well and play well now. And when they show up on campus, that's where my focus is. There's obviously a long-term picture to that, but we're trying to get them to shoot the lowest possible score they can every single day. And we spend a lot of their time on that. So, you know, these guys, most of them can hit it pretty well. So in the college golf atmosphere, you're spending a lot of time from 130 yards and in really polishing that area.
You got one, Dave?
I do. As the coach of a national championship winning team, how do you bring the team together in a, you know, kind of the landscape of a showcase of individual talent? I'm the coach of a high school team trying to get to a state championship, and have had players like Andrew McLaughlin, Miles Russell, players who are world class. What do you do to keep the team playing as a team outside of their individual accolades to win a championship as a team when you have some great talent around you?
Yeah, it's tricky. It's just such an individual sport. And, you know, from the age of 3, 4, 5, whenever they start until 18, when they get to college, it's just been about them. And their parents focus on them, and their golf coach focuses on them, and their whole team focuses on them. And then you get to college, and you do. You know, for you to win a tournament as a team, you got to have four other guys that are contributing and playing well. And the trickiest part for a coach, I think, is if you have one player that's really negative, it can kind of seep through the rest of the team. You know, my old thing that I learned from my college coach, he always talked about Lee Trevino. Lee Trevino would never sit with guys at lunch who talk about bad putting, who talk about three putting. He wouldn't do it. He literally, I guess back in the day, I didn't know him, but Coach Knight told me this all the time. He'd get up from the table and he would not listen to people who talked about bad putting. And so I've always kind of taken that with me. I grew up playing hockey. That was my sport growing up in Canada, and it's all team. And that's what I really admire about the NHL and hockey teams is the players are constantly talking about their teammates and what someone else did. It's always about someone else. And so we just try and keep our standards really high and, you know, set the tone for what's acceptable about, you know, how you come back from a bad round and how you can vent about that. But it's not easy, you know, in an individual game that, you know, essentially our 8 or 9 guys, they're trying to beat each other for a spot on the team. And I know that happens in football and basketball too. They're all competing for playing time, but it's certainly tricky. But you know, that's one of the things we really recruit character. You know, character is really important in adversity. You know, when you don't make the lineup for the first time or you play poorly, your character usually comes out. And if you've got a bunch of really good kids, which we have now, you know, we've adversity's helped us instead of hurt us. So I don't know if I answered the question, but
I was hoping you were going to say like Zen Buddhism or something.
Yeah. There's no, it's a tough one with golf because it is individual.
It is.
And, and your teammate does not, your teammate can't positively affect you. But my big thing is if I'm in the number one player and I'm watching the number two player in the group behind up on the green and he's got terrible body language and he's acting emotionally, that we do not put up with that. Hmm. That just does not help our team. I want a group of guys who are calm in the adverse times and maybe can show some positive emotion. Because momentum, I've seen it happen a lot in college golf. Like you'll look at a team scorecard and you'll have a back nine where all five guys shoot under par. And they're somehow feeding off each other. So how do you create those positive moments? That's the trick as a coach.
Yeah.
You know, all these kids come to you, they have elite coaches or elite players. So how do you manage that during the playing season, especially when guys start playing bad?
That's been my favorite part of the job is the people. I didn't know Travis before I got into this position. I've just got to meet such unbelievable people throughout doing this. And a lot of it's from our great players bringing coaches to our program. I think of Claude Harmon and Sean Foley and Jeff Leishman and Jeff Smith, all these great Cameron McCormick, all these great coaches that I've been exposed to throughout the years and got to learn from. We welcome that. You know, they've been working with these players for, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years. We're not about to just take over the whole deal, especially when it comes to their golf swing. And I really value as a coach time. Chris Como is another one that I'm thinking about right now, who's Kurt Kitayama, who I worked with for a long time. Kurt's now working with Chris, and I look at how Chris has gone about the process with Kurt and how much time he took and how many questions he asked and how many hours we spent on the phone together, him trying to learn and get to the next level with Kurt. I really value that process, and I think it's really, really important to know someone's game before you take it at our level, you know, when they're an elite player, before you make too many, you know, big changes or assumptions. So I'm super biased to it. I was a pretty good player, like I said, and I went to a different high school and my game went the wrong direction. And I just got too much thrown at me too fast that I didn't understand. So we probably err on the other side. But that's the greatest gift of coaching in college golf is all the people you get surrounded with and how much you're able to learn.
Mm-hmm. True. Yeah.
Were you surprised when they won the national championship, or did you know going in they had a chance?
So that team was such a development. It was what a journey we went on. Same team that 2 years prior missed the cut at the national championship. We didn't even play the final round. And then the next year, when they were all juniors, you know, you start to see some maturity and some growth and development and all these decision-making and different things and understanding of their game. I think Dudley and I got better at coaching and learned some things about, you know, the Arizona golf and the heat and firm greens, and we made some adjustments, and we finished 10th the next year. And then the final year at Greyhawk, we had a great team. We had won 5 times going into that final tournament. Mm. We had some superstars. I mean, Fred Biondi and Ricky and Yushin Lin were 3 of the best players in all of college golf. I think they were all in the top 10 of that PGA Tour U. Fred won that individual national championship that year. So we had the horses. But, you know, you look back on winning that, we were in trouble against Virginia in the quarterfinals in the match play, found a way to beat them. We were dead against Florida State. We were down 2-0 with 2 matches tied, and one of them, Ricky, was 1 down or 2 down with 3 to go, and somehow we flipped all 3 of those matches and beat them in the semis, and then we played great against Georgia Tech in the finals. So it was a development. We had a lot of rough times. And a lot of lows with those guys in their sophomore and junior years. But by the time they got to, we were lucky to have, we had four seniors in the lineup that year, and Matthew Kress was the lone freshman. But we had so much experience and obviously great players that, you know, they just, they were meant to do it. Mm. And that, I'll never forget that. It was one of the greatest experiences of my life. Yeah, it's changing a lot, unfortunately. Maybe not for the better, but the landscape of all of college golf is changing, and the money's big, and you know, football drives a lot of that. So our rosters are getting smaller each year. So I've had a roster as big as 14 throughout my career, but you know, the Southeastern Conference, the SEC that we're in, is looking at possibly going down to 8. As low as 8 for next year. So that's a huge difference there. And the spots are really limited and coveted. So, yeah, it's, you know, we would love to have more, you know, in the current setting that it is now. You know, Fred Biondi probably wouldn't have been able to be on our team. And he might be, you know, maybe one of the most successful college golfers ever. And he may not have had that opportunity. So it's changing fast. It's unfortunate.
It is unfortunate. It's similar to with PGA Tour now in Monday qualifying.
Yes.
And, you know, just taking spots away for that entry, I don't want to say entry level, but like, you know, for that opportunity.
Journeyman.
The journeyman, the opportunity, and needing that opportunity and then thriving off of that and building off of that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's tough.
It is tough. Yeah. I had no idea. 8.
Yeah. I've always, my whole career been, you know, a giver of opportunities, and now it feels like we don't have as many. So it's tough.
Stupid question. Can you redshirt them like in football, or do they like transfer out of there if they're not, say, in that 8?
I love football's rule. So in football, you can play up to 4 games and still redshirt. As soon as you hit one shot in competition with golf, you burn a year. So we don't have those same kind of redshirt rules. We have redshirted players in the past, but you know, having 8 guys on the team, I don't really see how a redshirt's going to be possible going forward, for the most part, an intentional redshirt.
Is in the transfer portal, is that all the same?
All part of golf, supposedly all going to be the same, but I mean, it's our game's going to look completely different in 2 years than it does right now. We've been really lucky because the transfer portal has only helped us. We've gotten, you know, Ian Gilligan, who we talked about earlier, who works with George. He was a transfer from Long Beach and been one of the best players in the country for last year and this year for us. And, you know, we won a national championship with Yushin Lin, who transferred from USC. So we've hit some home runs, in the transfer portal, but, I'm still trying to figure it all out, and kind of, it's just when you only have 8 guys or 9 guys going forward, it's going to be really hard to keep a spot open, you know, just because, you know, we started this fall with 9 and had a couple injuries, and all of a sudden you're down to 6 or 7 and you barely have enough guys to field a team. So a lot of adjustments coming up for sure.
All right. Good stuff. Thank you.
Cool.
We appreciate it.
Thank you.
You very
that
much.
That was awesome.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Appreciate it.
Thanks.
All right. Thank you for being here. We appreciate it. So, like I said, the next 3, we've got, we'll go in depth with some putting with Marcus in December, and then short game in January with Parker McLaughlin, and then, you know, a ways out Players Championship week with Dana Dahlquist. So thank you for being here.